All right, we are in Psalm 53 tonight, finished Psalm 52 last week. Psalm 53. Psalms 53. And you should know that Psalms 53 is a close match meet for Psalm 14. Of course, we've been through Psalm 14. There are some minor differences, and I looked at this passage, uniquely. Didn't go back and borrow notes from the last. So we'll go at it this way, and I'll point out some differences in a minute. Psalm 53, I also have a frog in my throat tonight. Don't worry, I'm not going to die from it or anything like that. But Psalm 53, verse 1. All right, a famous verse. Again, the match meet in Psalm 14, 1. The fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. Corrupt are they and have done abominable iniquity. There is none that doeth good. All right, the fool hath said in his heart, there is no God. That's not a very nice thing to say. That's the Lord, once again, telling you what man is like. And he says, the fool that said in his heart, there is no God. The fools would all call themselves something else, of course. They would call themselves sociologists or culturalologists or doctors of one thing or other or whatever. And I'm sorry, the Bible says they're fools. Lord says he looks upon that kind of wisdom of men and casts it down, and it's a snare to them, and they're just deceived. But the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. So the issue of there being no God is not an issue of evidence. It's not an issue of science. It is an issue of heart. The problem is they start out from the beginning in their heart saying, there is no God. That makes them fools, whether they have three doctorates or not. All right? The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. When you listen to somebody talk about there being no God, you're listening to a fool. And there's just no way, there's no pretty way to say it. So the Lord doesn't even try to say it pretty. He just tells you. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Now, the problem begins in the heart. It doesn't begin with evidence, and it doesn't begin with, somebody's kid dying young or something like that. It begins in the heart. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. A lot of stuff starts in the heart. That's where the main problems of all men start, in the heart. Look in Psalms 10. There are several hooks in Psalm 10 that remind us of Psalm 53, but Psalms 10, and the theme is the wicked. You see the wicked several times, verse 2, 3, 4, 13, and 15, several times through here. That's the theme. He says in verse 1, why standest thou far off, O Lord? Why hidest thou thyself in times of trouble? The wicked in his pride doth persecute the poor. Let them be taken in the devices that they have imagined. For the wicked boasteth of his heart's desire and blesseth the covetous whom the Lord abhorreth. The wicked through the pride of his countenance will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. And you've come to a day now where increasingly men spend no meditative time thinking about God. And you can nostalgically look back to the days of the farm where you plowed behind a mule for 8 hours a day. And so you didn't have much choice but to think about God, you know. And that's all fine and good, but there are so many distractions now. And there's just so much other stuff going on. And so it's a real battle. The battle of 2 Corinthians 10, the imaginations and so on, and the thoughts of the heart, that's a very real battle that needs to be fought today by each and every one of us. Now it says in verse 4, and I'm getting down to verse 6 in a sec. The wicked through the pride of his countenance will not seek after God. God is not in all his thoughts. His ways are always grievous. Thy judgments are far above out of his sight. He doesn't even think about God's judgments. I mean, when a volcano erupts and destroys a village, or a tsunami washes up and destroys an entire buku of coastal towns, nobody even thinks about it being God anymore. I mean, insurance companies used to acknowledge natural disasters. I'm not even sure if they acknowledge God. But it goes on to say, notice in verse 6, he, now this is the wicked, he hath said in his heart, I shall not be moved, for I shall never be in adversity. Now, there are things that men say in their hearts, and this is one of them. One thing is, there's no God. The other thing there in verse 6 of chapter 10, I shall not be moved, for I shall never be in adversity. In your prosperity, you might be, you know, tempted to say something dumb like that. Do you know how long it takes? You know, if God monitors your thoughts, the things that you say in your heart, do you know how long it takes him to take your prosperity away? I mean, it's just, you know, we are so vulnerable. And so you need to be careful what you say in your heart. Now, I know you're not wicked. I mean, I know you're wicked, but not wicked, wicked. It's one of those deals, you know. I mean, we acknowledge our wickedness, but we're not like some of them, you know. Okay, just be careful with that. Notice, if you will, verse 11, because it mentions it again. He hath said in his heart, God hath forgotten. He hideth his face. He'll never see it. So folks think they can get away with stuff. And how often we find that folks don't get away with stuff. Because whatever happens, the seed you put in that ground comes up somewhere along the way. Now go on down to verse 13 and notice another example. Wherefore doth the wicked contemn God? Now, they want to change that word to condemn. And if you do a little study on it, you'll find the Bible uses, the King James, uses both condemn, C-O-N-D-E-D-E-M-N, and the other forms of the word, and contemn, C-O-N-T, not D-E-M-N. And the idea there is it's one thing to condemn somebody. It's another thing to hold them in contempt. And so these folks don't just condemn God. They don't just berate God for allowing, if there is a God, for allowing the tsunami to kill the babies. And they don't stop there. They blame, they hold God in contempt for it. In other words, contemning somebody goes beyond condemning them. I believe those two words are different. I don't care how many of the new versions change them to mean the same thing. Back to verse 13, which I didn't finish what I was going for. He has said in his heart, thou wilt not require it. That's holding God in contempt. You won't require it. Lord's not going to require, you know, the United States to reap for what it's the new legislation that's being passed almost monthly. And they're wrong. That's holding God in contempt. That's saying, you know, God, you ain't gonna do nothing. We ain't seen you do nothing for thousands of years, so you ain't gonna do nothing. In fact, you're not even there. That's what the fool says. All right, with that in mind, let me just take you to one more passage in Psalm 95. We're looking at the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. And the problem is a heart problem. It's not a science problem. It's not an evidence problem. It's a heart problem. Now, Psalm 95 gives you an insight into the heart. And, of course, there's many, many verses along this line. But verse 10, in talking about the Israel being wandering in the wilderness and being tried there, it says in verse 10, 40 years long, was I grieved with this generation. And said, it is a people that do err in their heart. They have not known my ways. Now, I know, you know, there's lots of different errors. But all you have to do is go through the Bible to find the errors. And most of those errors begin in the heart. Eve began her long time as a sinner, by first thinking things in her heart before she actually fell. and what she was thinking in her heart about God and the way that she was willing to think about him as cheating her, and those things led her to do what she did. And so that's what I mean when it says error of thought is not like, you get a red mark, like that, and no repercussions. There sometimes is repercussions, because one error in thought leads to others. You get enough errors in thought, well, suddenly you're not thinking right. And suddenly you're not judging right and all that kind of stuff. And so there are errors in thought. Now, I was thinking about this thing with the fool has said in his heart, and just was thinking about the things that men have said in their heart. And I don't really need to take you through every one that I have written down here, but let me show you just how serious the Lord is about this thing. The Lord knoweth the thoughts of the heart. And so, folks, I mean, it is a battle. It's a battle that I've, tried to gain ground in, and I've lost so many fights in it, it's not even funny. So don't even pretend to tell you that I have won all the battles in it. But the battle for the thoughts and the imaginations is a battle worth fighting. Because where everybody goes wrong is, first of all, in the thoughts of their hearts. They err there first. Now notice this. Let me just give you a background in it and just tell me if I'm wrong. Look in Isaiah 14, where it's talking about the fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Well, that's a terrible, terrible mistake. Given that you have the handiwork of God written in the stars, given that every man is born with a conscience, given that every man is born with a natural witness to the veracity of the fact that there is a God. I mean, imagine looking at the complicated biological systems or whatever other kind of systems you think about and say, there's not a designer in all this. Somebody looking in your eye or in your ear, or now they're able to send little robots through your whole body to take pictures and stuff. That's kind of spooky. But looking at those systems and to think that all came about by chance, by some sort of natural development with proteins commingling with each other. What a bunch of ninnies when you stop and think about that stuff. I mean, it's complete idiocy. Now look here, I mean, beyond there being no God, look at where this all began. This transcends time. This goes back really before time was, as far as we see it. But Isaiah chapter 14, this is the devil, right? Verse 12. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground, which didst weaken the nation? This passage gives you the background for, Satan falling. But verse 13 is what we're after. For thou hast said, where? There it is. Satan said in his heart, I will ascend into heaven. Didn't even say he said it out loud. Now, I think eventually he probably did. But he said it first in his heart. So you got to be careful of ambition, ambitious thoughts. And the idea that, you're going to get a leg up on somebody else and you're going to do it in a wicked way. But thou said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I mean, that's where it started with the devil. Now, a few pages over to the right, look in Isaiah 47, and notice somebody else that says this. Now, this is a prophetic Babylon, a city, and it has implications for the future and all those things, but really not looking at that so much at the moment as this. Now, she is a wicked woman, and she's the virgin daughter of Babylon. In chapter 47, verse 1, there's a problem with nakedness, verse 3, a lady of kingdoms, verse 5, and she says all kinds of things. She says, for instance, in verse 7, thou saidst, I will be a lady forever, so that thou didst not lay these things to thy heart. So I'm never going to be judged. I can do whatever I want to do. Da, 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 da. So verse 9, you learn a little more, but these two things shall come to thee in a moment and one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon thee in their perfection, for the multitude of thy sorceries and for the great abundance of thine enchantments. She is a sorceress. And it's like I said, there's all kinds of prophetic implications. But verse 10 is what we're after. For thou hast trusted in thy wickedness. Thou hast said, none seeth me. Thy wisdom and thy knowledge, it hath perverted thee. And thou hast said in thine heart, I am and none else beside me. I am number one. I am the one that matters. The world should revolve around me. On Facebook. That's in the Hebrew. But it's that self thing. And you start thinking that stuff in your mind and you're going to get flipped out. You want me to prove it? Go to Ecclesiastes chapter 2. Ecclesiastes 2. Everybody knows when you turn from Proverbs to Ecclesiastes, there's kind of a change of spirit, right? Same author. In Proverbs, Solomon is right with God. In Ecclesiastes, he's experimenting with some other stuff, and it's not good, and you can't even pretend it turns out good. But chapter 2, verse 1, notice this. Okay, I said in mine heart, now this is the wisest man to ever live outside of Jesus Christ. Go to now, and I will prove thee. Talking about proving his heart with mirth. He's talking to his heart. I'm going to prove thee with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. And behold, this also is vanity. Now, he's experimenting with all kinds of things, right? Verse 12. And I turned myself to behold wisdom and madness and folly and all those things. And so he's experimenting in a way that the Epicureans would have, the way college kids do. And he thinks he's going to be able to come through because of his objective sensibilities, that he's doing this somehow as a scientific study to see, you know, the truth and the falsehood in it. Well, all kinds of people have tried that stuff, right? So you go on down to verse 15. That's what I want to hit. Because he spoke in his heart in verse 1. Now in verse 15, after going through this for a while, then said I in my heart, as it happeneth to the fool, so it happeneth even to me. And why was I then more wise? Pretty soon, if you're not careful with this stuff, you start questioning, why serve God? Why am I different? I'm going to die like everybody else, you know. And pretty soon you talk yourself out of your faith. It's from what you've said in your heart. I'll give you a few more examples. Well, I'll tell you a couple. Haman. Haman is called in before the king, and the king says, what should be done for somebody that the king desireth to honor? And you know what Haman said in his heart? He said, who would the king rather honor than me? And he winds up having to lead Mordecai around on the king's steed all through town, saying, this is how God, the king honors the man that he desireth to honor. Well, you know, his thought was, well, who could he want to do but me? Okay, it's dangerous stuff. You're not the bride at every wedding, nor the corpse at every funeral. Okay, it's not all about you. So just be careful with it, right? Let me show you another guy here, and it's just a study in the things that some of these fallen men said in their hearts. 1 Kings 12. It said, first of all, with the heart, long before it said with the mouth. And I'll acknowledge in a minute the Lord even acknowledges when something good is said in the heart. But the heart's deceitful above all things, desperately wicked. There's a lot less of what's good said than what's bad said. So, 1 Kings chapter 12 and verse 26. Now, this is, of course, Jeroboam. And you'll recall that what happens here in this passage is what puts Jeroboam on the Lord's blacklist for the rest of Israeli history. And Jeroboam is basically becomes the standard bearer for wickedness. And all the time the Lord is referring back to the sins of Jeroboam, the sins of Jeroboam. So, 1 Kings 12, verse 24, then saith the Lord, thus saith the Lord, ye shall not go up nor fight against your brethren, the children of Israel. Return every man to his house, for this thing is from me. They hearkened therefore to the word of the Lord, and returned to depart according to the word of the Lord. Now, here's what I wanted. Sorry. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in Mount Ephraim, and dwelt therein, and went out from thence, and built Penuel, And Jeroboam said in his heart, now shall the kingdom return to the house of David. It's a split kingdom now. And he, of course, wants to keep his part of the kingdom secure. And he's afraid. He's afraid in his heart that everybody's going to want to go back to Jerusalem like they're supposed to and worship. And so it's a practical problem. And he wrestles with this practical problem by saying, oh, this is going to happen. And he says this in his heart. Before it's over, he's one of the worst idolaters in the Bible. And he is roundly cursed and condemned by God for the rest of his lifetime and long after he died because of what he said in his heart. I have just a couple more for you. Look in Genesis 27. Genesis 27. The story of Esau. And that whole thing started, it says it started with what he said in his heart. Genesis 27, verse 41. Genesis 27, 41. And Esau, Esau sold his birthright. You say, well, that rascal Jacob, he cheated him out of his birthright. He bought his birthright. Yeah, well, Esau was selling. I mean, it's one thing. Jacob deserves condemnation in some respects. That's certainly true. But Esau was selling. You can't buy unless somebody's selling, right? And then on top of it, of course, Jacob cheats Esau out of his blessing by putting goat skin on his hands, and his mother helped him out with it and all that, so that his father thought he was Esau. Verse 41, and Esau hated Jacob because of the blessing wherewith his father blessed him. And Esau said in his heart, the day of mourning for my father are at hand, then will I slay my brother Jacob. Okay, he said that in his heart, right? So how come in verse 42, in these words of Esau, her elder son, were told to Rebekah? Well, most people don't keep their mouths shut very well. And he said it first in his heart, then he had to tell somebody. And pretty soon, the somebody told his mama. And pretty soon, it was known that Esau was going to kill his brother. So I wanted to show you one other thing with this. And like I said, there is a positive, if this is positive. Look in Genesis 20. And there's another guy that the Lord acknowledges, and you might not think the Lord should have. I'm not sure. But in Genesis 20, Abraham has lied about his wife being his sister. And because of that, Ahimelech has gone and picked up Sarah, and he has designs to make her his wife, I suppose. Verse 3, but God came to Abimelech in a dream by night, said to him, behold, thou art but a dead man, for the woman which thou hast taken, she is a man's wife. Interestingly, now this is Abimelech, this is a Philistine king, so we don't think of the Philistines particularly as having a lot of virtue, But notice it says in verse 4, but Abimelech had not come nearer. And he said, Lord, wilt thou slay also a righteous nation? Said he not unto me, she is my sister? And she herself said, he's my brother. In the integrity of my heart and innocency of my hands have I done this. And God said unto him in a dream, yea, I know that thou didst this in the integrity of thy heart. He acknowledges that Abimelech acted in the integrity of his heart. We don't usually think about that in a Philistine king, right? My point is the Lord notices both. You're not given an awful lot of times that the Lord does much acknowledging of the heathen's hearts thinking the right thing. There's lots more cases where it's the opposite. It's true, but it's still true that they do, or they can. Back to Psalm 53. So, excuse me again. The fool has said in his heart, there is no God. Corrupt are they. That's the reason they say it, because they're corrupt. They've corrupted themselves. Corrupt are they. And so we could run a bunch of verses on corruption. We have in 1 and 2 Timothy already, of course. You have Jannes and Jambres, who withstood Moses, and they were men of corrupt minds. And You know, it warns you over and over again, for instance, 2 Corinthians 11, where it says, I fear lest by any means as Satan beguiled Eve through his subtlety, so your minds should be corrupted from the simplicity that's in Christ. And so you have to be careful about corruptive influences. So when you're sending your kids off to school to read science books written by men who don't believe in God and do everything that they can to you know, overthrow that, you're exposing them to corruption. We usually think of corruption as, you know, gross pornography or some awful thing like that. Well, this is awful too, right? Verse 1, corrupt are they and have done abominable iniquity. That phrasing doesn't happen in any other place, unless actually it may happen back in Psalm 14 where it was stated before. Abominable works, yeah. But abominable iniquity. That they have done abominable iniquity. That doesn't sound like something small, right? But then you have to remember that the things that the Lord even calls, adultery, villainy, right? It's a heinous crime in Job. Heinous crime. It's not a small thing. Remember the passages we've run on mischief? Where mischief is wanting to kill somebody or wanting to trick them and damn them to hell. Okay, mischief is not Dennis the Menace. Right? There are other passages, there are other words like that. Okay, there is none that doeth good in that light. Verse 1. We'll mention that in a second because it happens again. Verse 2, God looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand or did seek God, and he found none. Every one of them is gone back. They're all together become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. As far as sin's concerned, you're worse than you think. You know, when the Lord found you, you're worse than you think. Whatever your conception was when you were 10 like me and got saved, or when you were 25 and like you when you got saved, you were worse than you thought. And it says there, God looked down from heaven. Let me just touch this. It doesn't say very often that God looked down from heaven. I'm glad that God looks down in more than one way, actually. Look in Psalm 102. And I think this is the only other place that it specifies that God looked down from heaven. Psalm 102. Psalm 102, verse 19, for he, God, hath looked down from the height of his sanctuary. From heaven did the Lord behold the earth, to hear the groaning of the prisoner, to loose those that are appointed to death. That's a blessing, isn't it? That the Lord is able to look down from heaven and sure enough see the sin, but also to hear the groaning of the prisoner, like where you were when you needed to get saved. Right? All right, back to Psalm 53, verse 2. God looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand, that did seek God. Okay, to see if there were any that did understand. Understand what? Well, let's start with Job. Job 28. What does it mean to understand? And I know you know it's easy to presume you know what it means to understand, but Job 28, and see what the Bible says in verse 28. And a man, he said, behold, the fear of the Lord, that is wisdom, and to depart from evil is understanding. So if you didn't depart from evil, you don't really understand, right? I mean, you need to quit, or you don't really understand. One more along that line. This time it's going to be Proverbs. Proverbs, two definitions of understanding. Proverbs 9. And you know the first part of this by heart, but sometimes the latter part, I think, is ignored. Proverbs 9. and verse 10. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Okay. And usually the rest of the verse isn't quoted. And the knowledge of the holy is understanding. Now, brethren, that's doctrine. That's hard Bible. That's deep Bible. That's the knowledge of God. That's what God put in the book for sound words, sound doctrine. And that's why you're supposed to learn it. Because without it, you're not going to understand. So it goes in combination. It's what you know, and it's what you quit. It's what you know, and it's what you get away from. Right? And if you know, otherwise you don't understand. He says back in Psalms 53, it says, God looked down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there were any that did understand, that did seek God. Okay, that did seek God. Two things. He wants to know if somebody understands. He wants to know if somebody seeks God. Okay, so we love the image, the metaphor of, the shepherd seeking us. And we know that God sent his only begotten Son into the world to seek us. Came to seek and save that which is lost and all those things. It's still man's responsibility to seek God. It's not all God. A Calvinist has it being all God. But the sooner you seek him, the sooner you find him. The sooner you seek him, the more likely he is to reveal himself to you and to put himself in a place where you can get to him. Right? Don't think it's not a man's responsibility to seek God. He said, I looked down from heaven to see if there were any that did understand, that did seek God. And in this case, the answer came back very negative. Every one of them is gone back. Gone back from what? From understanding. From seeking. Every one of them is gone back. They are altogether become filthy. So combine that with abominable iniquity and altogether become filthy. There is none that doeth good, no, not one. I mean, this is, we just think of sins as common sins. The Lord looks at our world as a sewer pit. It's worse than we think. And he says, they are altogether become filthy. Look in 2 Peter chapter 2, just a minute. We're not going to run the whole gamut of verses on filth. But 2 Peter chapter 2, and notice verse 7, 2 Peter 2, 7, where we quote this in part all the time too, that Lot was vexed with the filthy conversation of the wicked. And it's not talking about talk either. It's talking about what they were doing, how they were living, right? The Bible also talks, of course, about filthy lucre. But he looked down, and all our righteousnesses were as filthy rags before him. And so filth. They are altogether become filthy. Now, there is none that doeth good, no, not one. So, believe it or not, there is none that doeth good. Those phrases are limited in the Old Testament to Psalm 53, those two places, and then Psalm 14 in two places. And the only other place you find it, you find over in Romans chapter 3. Romans 3. The reason I bring that up is because, this passage here in Psalm 53 is a pretty sobering passage. I mean, it's talking about abominable iniquity, and it's talking about they're all together become, I mean, they are filthy through and through. And that's the passage that Paul quotes when he says in chapter 3, verse 10, as it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. We just read that. It's phrased slightly different. They are all gone out of the way. They're all together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good. So how sinful were you? You're pretty sinful. It's worse than you thought, right? And so, you know, the good news with that, of course, is that, you know, after you're saved, that you're washed in the blood, you have a standing with Christ. And the fact of the matter is, it's still pretty bad. If you're leaning on your own righteousness like some Baptists do, it's still pretty bad. And so you're going to need grace all the way through, and you need the blood of Christ every day. Okay, back to, if you will, back to Psalm 53. All right, into the verse. They're all together become filthy. Verse 3, there is none that doeth good, no, not one. Have the workers of iniquity no knowledge? Well, you know, like we said back on talking about that understanding, and generally no. I mean, how many folks that you know that are lost, how many of them have any knowledge whatsoever, really, of God, of knowledge of the holy? Not much. Stuff they've heard, right? I mean, stuff they picked up at Mass and stuff they picked up here and yon, and somebody went to, you know, sat in the doctor's office and read the, you know, the Mormon material that used to be free to read at the doctor's office or something like that. But general stuff about God, but they don't have any real knowledge. And so that's why the Bible says what it says here. Look in Hosea chapter 4. Hosea 4, I know he's talking to Israel doctrinally with this, but it's certainly true of us. Here we live in a quote-unquote Christian country, and that's a misnomer. I don't care what anybody says, it is a misnomer. It's never been a Christian country. It has been a country that has had the influence of Christianity and the influence of the gospel. But as far as being a genuine Christian country, there were none of the colonies were Christian colonies, like biblically Christian, right? So I won't get off on all that. All right, fine. Hosea 4. Not disdaining the Christian, the biblical influence, because that's real and it's what's preserved, I think, us for as long as we've been preserved. It doesn't take a genius to figure out that the mass of the populace is now moving way far away from that, just about as fast as they can run. And so the result is chapter 4, verse 1 of Hosea. Hear the word of the Lord, ye children of Israel. And I know that's the children of Israel. For the Lord hath a controversy with the inhabitants of the land, because there is no truth, nor mercy, nor knowledge of God in the land. Now that's real sad for them, because they're the ones that followed the pillar of fire and cloud through the wilderness. And they had the experience, and all through their history, they had the experience of seeing God's miracles and signs at some level or another, which is not something you've ever enjoyed. So it's sad that that can be the case with them. It's also the sad case with God's people. I'm talking for now about the church. For instance, verse 6. I believe this is true of the reason the church is in the shape it's in. I don't mean your church. Look, we're not perfect, okay? But your church is the exception among churches. There are others like us, but all you have to do is go look for another church, and you'll find that there's a difference. Okay? And because the vision at most fundamental, independent, many King James places is not to impart the knowledge of God at the level that we're talking about. They want it at a comfortable level. A little here, a little there. It's watered down. Bad. Okay? And you got missionaries here that have been traveling the country visiting churches, and you have others that have sought for churches, and there's not that many. I'm not taking credit for it. We're all taking some credit in the sense that we've all contributed to make it what it is, and with the Lord's help, right? It's no single person's thing. It's no single person's vision. But you need to take, you know, serious account of the fact of what you get. Because in verse 6, My people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. And you've watched fundamentalism die to almost having no effect whatsoever. I personally blame it on the fact that you have pastors that play the same string all the time. I mean, there is no new tune ever. Tithing, attendance, soul winning service. Tithing, attendance, soul winning service. And if you can say that you have been to other places and you get fed here, or you go to Peacocks and get fed there, or you go to PBI and get fed there, it's a different kind of feeding than you get at the church down the street. Even if it is a so-called, you know, King James church, oftentimes. Okay, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge, because thou hast rejected knowledge, I will also reject thee. That thou shalt be no priest to me. And I just wanted to see one other verse here, if I can find it. Go down to chapter 6, Hosea 6. Hosea 6 and verse 6. I desired mercy and not sacrifice, and the knowledge of God more than burnt offerings. I know it's Old Testament, I know that. But it doesn't mean the knowledge of God is any less important now than it was then. Okay? All right. Another verse or two on this subject here with as far as the knowledge of God's concerned. The text in Psalm 53 says, have the workers of iniquity no knowledge? In general, no, they don't. Isaiah chapter 5. Isaiah 5. Isaiah chapter 5, verse 13. Therefore, my people are gone into captivity because they have no knowledge. And there's lots of things that contribute to Laodicea. You're no longer in the Philadelphia church age, or Sardis, or any of the rest of them. You're in Laodicea. And there's lots that contributes to that, and lukewarmness and all those things. But the knowledge of God helps to defray it. And it's not good when folks just give up and start going to a big circus of a church where they're never taught nothing. It's not good. It's not good. The rock and roll's good, but that's it. And I say that with tongue in cheek, just in case you don't know. All right, that's it for tonight. Any questions or comments?